Hello, my name is Ben Jenkins. Welcome back to another season of the ACN podcast, the official podcast of the Australian College of Nursing. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Caleb Ferguson. Dr. Ferguson is a fellow of the Australian College of Nursing, as well as the European Society of Cardiology and the Cardiovascular Society of Australia and New Zealand. Caleb is a highly experienced registered nurse, particularly in the areas of cardiac and stroke nursing. Caleb is a postdoctoral fellow for the Heart Foundation, an editor for the Journal of Heart, Lung, and Circulation, and has contributed to the development of numerous national guidelines for the diagnosis and management of atrial fibrillation. Caleb, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Ben.
No, I'm excited to have you on. Now, I could probably guess with your significant history within the areas of atrial fibrillation and stroke nursing, I'm pretty safe to assume that's what today's scenario has all got to be about. So I guess we'll get starting to talking about the scenario. So I'll set the scene. So Caleb, you're a registered nurse working on a stroke unit. After receiving handover from the night staff, you introduce yourself to your patients and immediately get stuck into attending vital signs. You start showering your patients, assisting with breakfast, administering medications, and everything else that comes with working a very busy morning shift. Now, it gets to mid-morning and you notice that a family member arrives to see one of your patients. Mary has come to see her father, Jeffrey. Jeffrey is a 71-year-old gentleman who was recently admitted due to ongoing falls at home. It was noted whilst in the emergency department that Jeffrey was found to be in AF, or atrial fibrillation. Jeffrey does not have a past medical history of AF. Jeffrey was commenced on apixaban, and on your later set of vital signs, you noted Jeffrey's heart rate was 88 beats per minute and remains irregular. All other vital signs remain within normal limits. Now, Mary starts to speak to her dad, and you notice that Jeffrey is finding it difficult to explain his newfound diagnosis of AF. He looks at you as the nurse and asks if you could explain what atrial fibrillation is to the daughter. So Caleb, given your history within AF, how would you explain what atrial fibrillation is to a family member?
Sure, thanks. I think this is quite a common scenario as well, particularly in the acute stroke unit. And we often see patients that arrive into the stroke unit that don't know that they've had a previous history of atrial fibrillation, and the first time that they're aware and have a new diagnosis of AF is actually during their first stroke event. So this comes as quite a shock to them sometimes, that they've had this abnormal heart rhythm disorder, and often this has been a cause or a contributing factor to their stroke event as well. So I often describe this to patients and their families as being the most common heart rhythm disorder, we call it a cardiac arrhythmia. And sometimes that can be quite technical for patients as well. Sometimes I might explain to them that it's usually, you know, the heart's out of sync and the heart has a few different chambers in it, and sometimes they don't beat in a normal rhythm as they should do. And that causes a few problems for patients sometimes, in that the blood can pool in an area of the heart and causing there to be a clot, and sometimes what happens is that clot travels from the heart up through the neck vessels and lodges within one of the vessels within the brain, and that's what causes there to be a stroke. So I think describing it a little bit, you know, in layperson language like that can be quite helpful for patients. And still, I think some patients don't connect the heart connecting with the plumbing, with the brain. And often we see these types of strokes as often more severe and more disabling. And that's really due to the area of brain that's affected. So commonly these are larger strokes and more severe. But as I said sort of before, sometimes patients have had a diagnosis of AF in the past and they're aware of that. And sometimes this is the first event that they've had. So we know that AF is present in ischemic stroke in about sort of 25 to 30% of patients with ischemic stroke. So it's a major risk factor for stroke. But these types of strokes are highly preventable. And I guess, to me, this presents quite a complex issue, and having worked in the stroke unit, you know, I would often see patients that would come in like this and think, you know, how can we prevent these types of strokes from happening? And I think that the problem really is sort of threefold in that patients sometimes don't know that they have AF. So really that asymptomatic nature of AF, a lot of the time, you know, AF has symptoms. Sometimes these are quite vague and they can range from things like palpitations, but also fatigue and tiredness, or a bit of shortness of breath, or dizziness, really. So it's hard to pinpoint those symptoms sometimes. But so really, you know, knowing that someone has AF, sometimes it's quite difficult to pick that up and to diagnose. But so the diagnosis issue is a bit of a problem. But then it's also around optimizing treatment and therapy for those patients that have diagnosed AF. So making sure that they receive the right treatment. So whether or not that's pharmacological or non-pharmacological, in the use of different devices or medications. So really optimizing treatment for those patients is sort of a secondary aim. But then also thirdly, this issue around sort of what I frame as adherence and persistence with those therapies is really important. So, you know, optimizing the evidence-based therapies is very important. But then the majority of these patients are going to be on often lifetime duration of medications, particularly those like anticoagulant medications used to prevent stroke. So it's really important that these patients are really well informed around these, their condition and the medications themselves, to really optimize self-management and improve adherence and persistence with taking those medicines, often for a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So I think the use of, you know, when we think about educating patients and Mary and Jeffrey, to go back to your case study here, I think this can range from having a bit of an informal conversation, opportunistic education at the bedside with Mary and with Jeffrey, just for a short period of time, and explaining about this, you know, what is AAF and what are some of the common therapies and approaches to its management. But also we might do a bit of more of a sort of structured education session, really sort of describing some of the other stroke risk factors and things that compound that diagnosis of AF. But I also think the use of different aids can be helpful. So things like videos or diagrams, or I've known people to even sort of draw sort of small figures of the heart and really get down and explain to patients about that. You might also hear some other people sort of talk about it being an electrical problem of the heart, and sometimes that's helpful for some patients to get their head around too, but sometimes that's quite strange for people to hear that language as well. Yeah.
I can imagine that as you're explaining it, and especially using those words that we're using before about how you've got the clot that can lodge into the brain, I can imagine that Mary would probably look at you at that time and probably look quite concerned. And then Mary would look at you and say, and ask you whether atrial fibrillation is dangerous. How would you sort of respond to a patient's family member asking you whether this new condition that I've been diagnosed with, is it dangerous?
I think this is quite an interesting question around the danger of AF. Yeah. And, you know, I think like historically, you know, in practice, I think the way that we as nurses thought of AF, probably even sort of like 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, it was just, it's something in handover that we would just be like, it's just a bit of AF. They've got AF. And you're like, all right, that's okay. It's not too major a sort of comorbidity to live with. And it's just a little bit of AF. But I think, you know, probably this sort of framing of a little bit of AF is probably quite dangerous in itself. Because of the clinical consequences of AF, and if untreated, really is a life-threatening disorder, and it has really serious clinical consequences if left unmanaged a lot of the time. I guess that also on the flip side, to say that a lot of people live very well with AF, they are really sort of not bothered by it too much and manage to live very well lives with it as well. But I think in this, you know, thinking about the serious clinical consequences of AF And there's been a lot of research into what's most feared in terms of the clinical consequences. And so stroke is the major risk factor for those patients living with AF are at a five-fold risk of developing stroke. But there's emergent literature really around AF as a risk factor for dementia. And we also know that patients with AF go on to develop heart failure. And around about, sort of 30 to almost 50% of patients with heart failure will have AF. And a lot of patients that have AF will go on to develop heart failure as well. So these are really quite serious comorbidities. And there's a good few papers recently that talk around AF really not existing in isolation. We used to have this category of AF that we used to call lone AF, But there's some new literature that says really, rarely do you have AF just in isolation, and it's often linked with other comorbidities. So I guess those, when we're thinking about the danger sort of factor, people are quite familiar with what a stroke is, or dementia as well, and thinking about this disease, atrial fibrillation, and framing it as a disease and a comorbidity can lead to these potentially more serious disabling comorbidities can be quite worrying for a lot of patients and concerning and troubling for them.
Now, within this scenario as well, Jeffrey was commenced on a new medication, which was apixaban. Especially since you're here explaining what all of this is, he mentions that he feels a little bit bad because the doctor had only just mentioned what apixaban was, but now he's looking at you and asking a little bit more about it, just to get a bit more understanding. So how would you explain what that medicine is to our patient and to his daughter?
This is a great point around these novel or what we call NOACs or DOACs. So novel oral anticoagulants, or not so novel these days, direct oral anticoagulants. And so these are the new, well, they're not so new now, direct thrombin inhibitors in terms of the class type. So we have three in the Australian market now. So rivaroxaban, apixaban, and dabigatran. So dabigatran was sort of first in the market as one of these new novel oral anticoagulants. And they were really heralded as this great change in AF management and anticoagulation, because really for probably the last sort of 5 decades post-war, really, we only had one drug of choice, or one mainstay drug, which was warfarin, really. And we had aspirin as well as an antiplatelet, but we really primarily just used warfarin as an anticoagulant for the indication in the setting of AF for stroke prevention. And warfarin's really quite bothersome for a lot of patients, can be quite troublesome in terms of its interactions with other drugs, diet and lifestyle, and having to have regular monitoring, such as INR monitoring and bloods quite frequently, to make sure that patients are within that what we call time in the therapeutic range. And often that's between 2 and 3. So having to dose adjust that warfarin, and this can be, it's a bit bothersome for patients to keep managing. They often bruise a lot on anticoagulation as well. So when these new drugs sort of came to market, and these are fantastic clinical trials to go and have a look at, and I think all three of them are published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So I guess they're quite widely used now in the context of atrial fibrillation, very safe drugs. And it's often, when we think about AF, it's often this balance between the stroke risk and the bleeding risk on the other hand as well. And so we have different tools that we can use as nurses as well to calculate out the bleeding risk and the stroke risk. So for stroke, there's a tool called the CHADS-VA, which is recommended for use in the Australian AF guidelines to calculate stroke risk. And we can pinpoint that down, and it's a little bit works almost similar to like a pressure injury risk score, sure. at like the Waterloo or something like that. And you're adding up the numbers really that are relative to the different comorbidities and risk factors as well. So, and then on the other hand, we have a tool called the HAS-BLED, which is a tool that can be used for to calculate bleeding risk as well. So, apixaban and rivaroxaban and dabigatran are pretty safe drugs. And the good thing probably about them in comparison to warfarin is, you know, not there's no need for the dose adjustment, and dosing is a lot more simplified as well, and taking it generally is a lot more simple as well. Things that are important for patients to remember, though, there's a lot of education, I think, that still needs to happen around anticoagulation at the bedside. And from this is often, in the Australian context, quite frequently delegated and felt the responsibility of say, pharmacy or medical officers as well to go into this. But nurses really have a key role in unpacking this anticoagulation education with patients and their caregivers as well. And so we need to really be talking to things to patients around you know, bleeding. So whether or not that's from brushing the teeth and their gums are bleeding, or an epistaxis and, you know, nosebleeds and that sort of thing, can be quite you know, frightening for patients the first time they experience something like that as well. And things like knocks and bruises can be quite worrying for patients as well. But we also need to talk about, you know, sort of other factors with living with taking anticoagulation. So things around, you know, immediately stopping the medicines would be unadvisable. And a lot of patients sometimes get a bit misunderstood in terms of, oh, I feel better, so I no longer need to take this medicine. So we need to really reiterate to them that this isn't a medicine that sort of makes you feel better. It is something that's protective and works sort of in the background. And then there's other factors around sort of the coming into hospital again and pausing medicines for different procedures. So if they're having, you know, a colonoscopy or a pacemaker inserted or something like that, you know, having a chat to the doctor around, should I stop it or should I continue or should I move on to another drug as well, are really important things to be reiterating to patients. The other thing probably to mention, I sort of skipped over the aspirin thing and the antiplatelets earlier, but nowadays, you know, with NOACs and DOACs, we tend not to use aspirin for stroke prevention in the context of AF. So we used to, you know, think that it was okay evidence, that it did a lot and it was okay to have patients on that instead of warfarin. But now that the evidence is pretty weak and we tend not to recommend that for stroke prevention at all in AF. And actually the guidelines sort of say the patients are probably better on a NOAC than on one aspirin.
Now, I understand that with your research as well and your areas of interest comes to wearable technology. So the next question is one that I've been very much looking forward to asking you. So Mary, within the patient, within the scenario today, she mentions that she heard of the latest wrist-based watches and that they can detect irregular heart rhythms and asks whether this would be a wise investment for her father. So what sort of evidence are there behind these wearables?
Yeah, this is a great question and quite a contemporary one as well. I think there's a lot of these new devices around and they range and you know, they might be things from like the Apple Watch that's quite commonly worn, or the Fitbit, or a few other smartwatches as well. I guess in clinical practice, in terms of how we screen and detect for atrial fibrillation, we often use cardiac monitoring, so things like 3 and 5 lead monitors or telemonitoring, telemetry when we're in the acute stroke unit or cardiology, and or things like an ECG or a Holter monitor would be gold standard for diagnosing AF as well. But there's this proliferation of new devices, such as smartwatches. And in Australia, we've got now a few different technologies available that work pretty well to detect atrial fibrillation. A lot of the monitoring capabilities of say the Apple Watch, you know, in terms of to detect atrial fibrillation, aren't switched on or capable in Australia. But one of the things that's been around for a little while is the AliveCor device. So this is a small sort of smartphone device that's like a cover on your smartphone. You can click onto the back, and you can do a single lead ECG with this just by placing it on a patient and doing a sort of 30-second check. And it's pretty awesome in that you can do a single lead ECG, and you can PDF that and send it to a provider. So these are being used a bit more in clinical practice now, particularly by community nurses or CNCs or nurse practitioners that do home-based visits or clinics as well, and that they're quite small. So if they're at home, say as a heart failure nurse practitioner doing a home visit, and they think someone's in AF and just want to check what rhythm they're in and do a single lead ECG, they can do that on the spot and PDF that and send it off to the cardiologist or to the GP if they like as well. So some of these, in terms of say, what we call sensitivity and specificity, and in terms of being able to pick up AF, are quite good. And there's just been a recent study that was led by Bernard Yan, which is who's a neurologist in Melbourne. But it was a study in Australia and also in China as well that looked at the use of these devices, but in the acute care setting to pick up AF as well. Because typically in the stroke guidelines, we recommend that patients after stroke have around, I think we say, sorry, 72 hours of cardiac monitoring to detect AF. So, you know, these patients that come into the stroke unit, you know, go on a monitor, and we print off a rhythm strip every shift, or we have a little look and see if they're in AF. But they did a trial whereby nurses used the AliveCor device and did a single point in time measurement with this AliveCor device. And they actually found that they picked up more AF doing that than normally. So that was quite fascinating and really kind of makes you think about the use of these devices in the sort of contemporary acute care setting as well. And it'll be interesting to see if we start to use them a bit more. I guess one of the things that you know, the challenges, I guess, is to recognize that this is a single point in time measurement. So, you know, it's when you've got it on, and, you know, think often AF can be paroxysmal, so it's not there all the time and it comes and goes. And that's one of the challenges is picking it up really as well. So sometimes this continuous monitoring is what we want to do. There's also, so wearables are quite fascinating and very, you know, I think from the tech point of view, we're all like, wow, you know, this is going to change healthcare and how we pick up a lot of stuff. And being the futurist in me as well thinks one day we'll probably just have a little patch that we put on a patient as they come through the ED. And this patch is going to do their blood pressure, the temperature, their pulse and everything. And you know, so we won't be having to do our obs rounds and do all these measurements every 4 hours. So what are we going to be doing really as well? So that's pretty, pretty fascinating. But on the other hand, we've also got advances in implantable technologies and also for rhythm monitoring. So I don't know if you've come across, we've got a device that's licensed in Australia called the Lynx device. And this is a small sort of chip, and it's, to describe it, is probably about half of the length of your pinky. Okay. on your hands. So your pinky nail maybe. Yep. And this is a device that you can place subcutaneously just underneath the skin and close to the heart, and it will do rhythm monitoring and it can stay in there for quite some time and be transmitted And so things like that offer that continuous monitoring over time. So a lot of the patients whereby we used to call it cryptogenic stroke, but the phrase that's more commonly used now is stroke of an unknown origin. And so sometimes we think in those types of patients, an underlying undiagnosed arrhythmia might be the cause of the stroke event. So prolonged monitoring is sometimes quite helpful to pick up that undiagnosed AF. But I think the question of, you know, this thing of, oh, should I rush out and purchase a such and such a device? I think this is quite a troubling one for nurses to come up against, and particularly with, you know, getting asked about, should I have this app or should I buy this and that sort of thing. And I think it's often a good thing to review the evidence that underpins that and try explaining sort of that to the patients and to the family members and caregivers as well, around the, getting them to sort of understand that evidence of how effective some of these products are as well. Because really, I think we're becoming more and more common around the use of these devices and what we call digital therapeutics as well. So you know, app-based therapeutic healthcare interventions. And some of these, you know, are largely unregulated, unlike medicines. And so it's really important for us to advocate that patients understand the underpinning evidence. Yeah.
Well, Caleb, thank you very much for your time. I guess just in a recap from today's episode as well, I guess having worked in emergency and ICU, they're the two areas that I particularly have experience in. I guess AF is such a common condition that you see day to day. What I love just chatting to you about is, yes, it is a serious condition. As you mentioned, AF can just be overlooked. It's something that's so common. Therefore, it's just another condition that the patient has. But no, I think you've definitely highlighted, using a lot of the evidence and the research that you particularly undertake in your area, that it is a serious thing. We've really got to keep it in mind. Going through, explaining, especially the importance of nurses explaining to the patients and their family members exactly what this condition is, using all different forms of teaching tools, and just sort of the pivotal role that nurses can have in those discussions. And from the use of wearable technologies, I guess this is, as you're mentioning, it's such a developing field as well, and there seems to be some big things to come. But again, as nurses, looking at the evidence behind it. Done. Caleb, thank you so much for your time today, be on the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me again. Cheers.